A few days after the myriad had warned me that Oisin was angry, a storm came through the strait. It was fierce enough that my attendants couldn't work, but huddled in my lee as it swept over us. It blew all afternoon and into the evening, but eventually it passed. In the morning the sky was still full of clouds, and a mist hung over the harbour and the water beyond. Out in the strait, the waves rode high, crashing on the shores, as though the wind still drove them. Even in the harbour the water was rough, had been rough enough during the storm to scatter the flat, deflated pink and brown corpses of jellyfish along the quays. Below the surface, the water was muddied and darkened. If any boats were crossing the strait, we could not see them. But then anyone crossing the strait today might well be taking their life into their hands. Still, the watchers on the waterfront were vigilant. It was about noon when the ships loomed out of the mist. Six of them, long, low, single-sailed things. When they reached the harbour mouth, I felt the sudden pull of strength as the gods of Ardvuskdia called on my resources to bolster theirs, and a black whining cloud shot past the quays and out over the water, sped along by a gust of wind. A whale, 50 feet long, mottled grey and white, crusted here and there with barnacles, rose out of the water and crashed down onto the foremost boat. Beyond, dozens of long, needle-toothed gar and brown and blue weavers, spines extended, leapt onto the other boats, biting and flipping. The whale slid into the water. The foremost boat righted itself, people floating or thrashing helplessly in the water beside it. More gar, more weavers jumped out of the water and onto the boats, and I felt another drain of power as a wave swept across their decks, leaving masses of stinging jellyfish behind. The dark cloud reached the boats, hundreds of thousands of mosquitoes. They landed on the crew and passengers, biting and biting every inch of exposed skin, crawling into the smallest openings in armour under collars and sleeves, and biting the skin beneath. People clinging desperately to ropes, to the gunwales, so as not to be washed overboard, let go and dived into the water, desperate to escape the myriad's forces. The ships now were drifting, battered by the waves, by the whale, and by each other, and those remaining on the ships, bitten and stung, hard-pressed to reach an oar, a tiller, or a sail, let alone bring their ships under control. By now, Ardvuskdia's own boats were launched, aimed straight for the raven's beleaguered ships. The Ardvuskdian sailors hoped to capture some or all of those. The myriad's cloud of mosquitoes was much diminished now, but the gar and the weavers continued to jump onto the boats, the waves continued to deposit jellyfish, and every few minutes that barnacle-crusted whale breached and smashed into whatever lay beneath its fall. The gust that had blown the mosquitoes out to the boats returned as a steady, powerful wind that blew out from the harbour toward the open water, pushing the half-dozen boats around and back. That wind continued to blow steadily, but the mist did not blow away. I didn't know enough of the situation, didn't know enough about the raven and his forces to come up with a better plan, and so, at the moment, it was best to wait, to see what more the gods of Ardvuskdia might muster. Summoning that wind had surely taken a great deal of power, but at this time of day, when the breeze should be blowing strongly landward, keeping it steady would cost even more. I was even now being drained of my own power at an alarming rate, surely in aid of it. But Vastai's boats were in disarray, drifting uncontrolled while their crew and passengers scurried here and there in panic. They would doubtless be easily captured when the Ardvuskdian boats reached them. Unless the raven had something more planned, it seemed the battle was won. Was this all the raven had sent against us? It was not. The mist rolled aside, and over the water came thousands of armed and armored soldiers, marching on the air above the waves, as though over a bridge that lay across the strait. The boats, the jumping fish, parted before them. Power drained out of me, and a wave washed over the marchers. They did not waver even a fraction of an inch, but marched steadily forward. Some of the column split off to head for the Arvustian boats, to step out of the air onto the decks and slaughter the sailors. No weapon seemed to harm them. They slashed and hacked, some of them with swords or arrows lodged in their bodies, oblivious to what ought to have killed them. As the main column came closer, a sudden drain of my own power nearly knocked me out of the stones of the quay, and the wind blew with deadly force and pushed the first several ranks of marchers out of the air and into the water. And finally, I understood. The soldiers that had fallen floated in the water, now just rough-hewn logs of wood. The marchers were things of the god of the silent forest. This was surely costing the Iradeni gods a great deal. One log of wood made to look like a person to move to swing a sword, that might not be much for a large, powerful god. But thousands of them, moving and fighting continuously, marching over air as though it were solid ground, maintaining that movement and the illusion of humanity despite the combined opposition of all the gods of Ardvustia. That was surely the forest, and surely the result of a great effort. How could the raven be sure that this, finally, would break the gods of Ardvustia? He could not. I was sure this was not all that was coming. Another sharp drain of power drove me out of the quay, and I contracted back to only myself, turning, my attendants grim and silent as they shoved me around, tired, aching, the two girls weeping. They had been working without a break since the raven ships had come out of the mist, were now working through pain and exhaustion, but they did not waver. The myriad landed atop me.
"This is not good," she said.
"I don't entirely understand the purpose of the wooden marches," I admitted. "It seems wasteful and showy."
"I believe they are meant to do maximum damage to both the gods and the people of Ardvustia. No doubt the raven hopes it will be enough to exhaust Ardvustia's gods entirely, or if it does not, no doubt he hopes it will be near enough that he may merely speak his victory."
She cried. And at that moment, something must have happened in the harbour, because I momentarily found myself sightless, soundless, inside my stone self.
"Keeping them off the keys,"
the myriad still speaking to me.
"The defences are barely holding, but they hold. Perhaps this is all the thrust I can muster against us. Perhaps the raven will exhaust himself with this attack."
Surely the raven of Iriden was nearly as worn as the gods of Ardvustia after all this time. And if he failed now, if he drained his own strength too far, the untruth of his claim to the strait would rebound on him. He would be finished.
"Perhaps he is near the end of his own resources and has thrown everything into this final attack. If we can only hold out..."
And suddenly the drain, the steady sapping of my power, stopped. "Which god was drawing power from me?" I asked.
"Was?"
"Which god?" I insisted.
"Ardim Chak."
Ardim Chak had specialized in weather, had no doubt been behind the profoundly unlikely wind from the land out to sea.
"If they..."
"They aren't taking power from me anymore. If they've died, can Ardvustia still outlast the raven?"
"I wouldn't have thought so," said the myriad. "But I believe the defences still hold."
The raven had hoped, no doubt, to prevail by now. "Is it near enough?" I asked, for the raven to speak his victory.
The myriad did not answer, preoccupied, I suspect, with events elsewhere. My attendant still turned me. If those wooden soldiers made their way past the quays, they would no doubt march through the city, killing mercilessly. What would they do once they reached this gate, and my few tired, unarmed people?
Stop! I cried aloud.
It took a few moments for my attendants to realize that I had spoken.
What?
Asked Siat, my priest, still pushing.
What is it?
Stop!
I cried again, and they all four stopped. Half unwilling, they knew their efforts were contributing to the city's defense.
Flee, north. You will go unseen by enemies. Flee. You are under my protection.
And to the myriad I said,
you should go back to your stones in the north. Without delay.
But what about you? Asked the myriad.
But the battle?
Protested one of the women. And then the myriad cried,
the raven has...
And suddenly, I felt as though I had been struck a resounding, painful blow, and all was darkness and silence. Here is a story I have heard. Long centuries ago, the gods of Ardvustia promised the raven a share in the sacrifices and offerings they received because of his help in building the harbour. But nearly the moment the last stone was in place, they reneged on their deal, having found, or laid, a technicality in the words they had used. What was Vastai, and what were the gods of Vastai and Iriden, that the wealthy and mighty gods of Ardvustia would ever require their help or owe them anything? And so the raven declared war on the gods of Ardvustia. For years the raven and the forest were sore pressed by the attacks of the many powerful Ardvustian gods, made more powerful by their detestable practice of imprisoning smaller gods and forcibly draining them of their power. The raven's allies, of course, were all willing, even enthusiastic, volunteers. Though the god of the silent helped at first only in the most desultory way, when it finally realized the importance of the struggle to itself, the forest threw all it had into the war. Finally, the time came when Iridan's forces made their last desperate venture, one that had to win the war for good and all. Every Iridani boat on the shoulder sea set out that day for Ardvustia. Every ferry, every fishing boat, every simple craft filled with all the able fighters of Iriden. A terrible storm blew up to prevent them, but the raven calmed it, and the boats sailed on. Then a swarm of bird-sized insect horrors swarmed out of the skies, six-legged monsters that drank sailors dry with a single bite, leaving them desiccated husks. A dozen gape-mawed whales surged to the surface, swallowing whole boats. Horrible, poison-spined, dagger-toothed fish leapt out of the water to gnaw the living flesh off the Iridani soldiers' bones. Soon there were fewer than a half-dozen boats left, and dismembered corpses bobbed in the strait, tugged and chewed by horrors under the water, as the Ardvustian boats bore down on the few survivors. And then the god of the silent came marching to the rescue. At first the arrogant gods of Ardvustia thought it would be a simple thing to destroy the apparently human soldiers, even directly assisted by a god as they obviously were. But despite all the Ardvustian efforts to stop them, the marchers, the forest itself, came inexorably over the waves, dispatching the monsters, stepping into the harbour, onto the quays, into the city, and slaughtering all who opposed them. The god of the silent had stirred itself,
uprooted its own trees to come to Iriden's aid, and in its anger, even stronger than before with the deaths of the Iridani soldiers who had dedicated themselves to that god before setting out, the forest was too powerful to overcome. The gods of Arvustia exhausted themselves against the god of the silent, and the raven had but to speak them all dead, every god of Arvustia, and every god aiding the gods of Arvustia. The raven and the forest, between them, destroyed all the weapons, God-spoken or not, that Arvustia had used against Rastai, and then, still, after everything, as strong as ever, the forest returned to the silent contemplation of its trees, having promised to continue to protect and defend the people of Iriden at need. 127 people were hung on the Arvustian Key as sacrifices to the gods of Iriden, and a warning to any Arvustians who might be thinking of rebellion. The raven ordered a fortress built there, and a tower in Vastai, from which he could watch over the strait. Ever since, the two cities have been at peace, and health and prosperity have visited both Vastai and Arvustia. The raven, after all, has only ever been concerned with the well-being of his people. Only a story. Though if you have been listening to me and have understood me so far, you know that it is a story built around a particular selection of facts, twisted to particular ends. This version of events is widely repeated and believed all through Iriden, but it is rarely told in Arvustia, and then only by Irideni. People who pass on a different account of the events of that day generally don't do so within earshot of their Irideni conquerors. All things pass. Human life is brief. Even if the people in Arvustia on that day had been allowed to live long and peaceful lives, they would all of them be dead by now. What is the difference? Why should I care if one or another human die sooner rather than later, or violently rather than peacefully? I don't know. What I do know is that none of my four attendants were among those killed the day that Arvustia fell to the raven. For various reasons, I am fairly certain that while I lay outside the city wall insensible, they escaped the wooden marchers and the human soldiers and did as I had bidden them, and fled to safety in the north. Tikaz came into your room in the guest house in Vastai and said,
"Tell me, Mawat didn't do this."
Dry-eyed and blank-faced, her voice was flat and calm.
"Tell me he didn't kill my father."
"He didn't?"
You were sitting on the edge of your bed.
"He didn't do it. I was there. I had the thing, that cylinder in my hand, and I was watching the whole time. Some guards had his arms, and I was coming to give the cylinder to Mawat so he could get away. One of them, one of those two, grabbed Mawat's knife, and he was going to stab him with it, and your father stepped between them. I don't think he realised. Everyone was pressed close. I don't know if anyone else saw it."
"You'd lie for him," said Tikaz. Not as an accusation, but as a mere statement of fact.
"My lady," you said, "I'm not lying. That's what happened."
She said nothing, just stared at you, now frowning slightly. You said,
"The Lord Hebao has been looking for some excuse to be rid of my Lord Mawat. Those two are working for him. I heard them talking the first time I came up from under the tower. I don't think they meant to hurt your father, but it happened so fast.
Where's Mawat? Tikaz asked, her voice still chilly and even.
I don't know,
you said.
I gave him the thing and I don't know where he is now.
Tikaz didn't say anything for a few moments, and you added,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about your father.
It wasn't us,
she said, and she sat down beside you then and put her face in her hands and wept.
I'm sorry,
you said again helplessly. After a while, Tikaz said, her face still in her hands,
which one was it?
I don't know, I can't tell them apart.
I'll have to kill them both then,
she said, her voice slightly exasperated, as though she had just been presented with a minor, unexpected chore. You didn't seem to know what to say to that, and sat there looking at her. Where is Mawat? She asked again. Really?
I really don't know. He's probably trying to figure out some way to make Hibal pay the lease.
Tikaz looked up. Tears streaked her face and her eyes were red.
He could be right here, and we wouldn't know it.
He could,
you agreed.
But I imagine he's in the tower, watching his uncle.
Well, she said, rising, if you see him, tell him not to get in my way.
I will, lady,
you said, and she left. Not long after that, the tower servant came to find you.
Your pardon, sir,
he said, as though he had not brought you secretly to the top of the Raven Tower just days before. The Raven's lease requests your presence.
Mine?
You feigned unworried surprise.
Yours, sir,
the servant confirmed, as soon as you may be able to attend him.
Which is to say, immediately?
You guessed.
If you'll give me just a moment, I'll come right with you.
For all the world, as though the summons did not worry you in the least. But you went then to find the landlady's daughter and asked her if she knew where you might find the Lord Direction Dera.
He's gone to the tower these few minutes past,
she told you,
to attend the lease.
You thanked her and followed the servant out of the guest house, across the square, and into the fortress. In the tower yard, you met Depeju, standing, frowning at the tower entrance. There was no sign of the snake.
Ah, the friend de Ollo,
he said, as you passed.
You are not have that thing that is belong to us anymore.
I don't know what you mean,
you replied, not stopping.
Tell the Lord Mawat,
Depeju called to your back as you walked on,
that we are want to help, if he is want to help us.
Inside the tower, the ground floor was empty, as you had always seen it. On the next floor, the various members of the Council of the Direction stood in small groups around the dais with its carved bench, talking, waiting for Hibal to arrive so the day's suddenly urgent business could be attended to, the Lord Dera among them.
A moment, please,
you said to the servant, and went over to Dera. All the directions fell silent, watching you.
My Lord Direction,
you said to Dera,
can I beg a favour of you? I'm summoned to the presence of the lease, and I would prefer not to go unaccompanied.
Dera stared at you a moment, and then said,
yes, of course.
He nodded to the other directions and followed you out onto the stairs.
Were you there?
He asked quietly, as you ascended behind the servant. You looked at him, calculating, perhaps, and then said,
no.
On the roof, Hibal, white-clad, sat on one of the stone seats along the parapet, Askel and Arkim on either side of him. The cloud seemed darker than before, and the breeze blew damp and humid and smelled of rain.
"Raven's lease?"
you said, bowing. It cost you an effort to say the title without any rancour or irony. You managed to not even glance toward the second set of stairs or the raven's nest behind you, with its egg.
"You wanted me?"
You did not acknowledge the twins at all, or say anything about Dera standing beside you.
"Ah, the good Aiolo," said Hebal.
Askel and Arkim smirked.
"And the Lord Direction Dera, I see."
Hebal frowned. He had surely not expected you to bring anyone, let alone a member of the Council of the Directions.
"Is there some reason you feel you need the assistance of the Lord Direction? Is there some petition you would make, or some case you need to bring?"
"I am only a farmer's son from Oenda, Raven's Lease," you said.
"It's my business to assist the people of my district,"
Dera agreed mildly. Hebal considered this, still frowning, and then asked,
"Where is Mawat?"
"I don't know, Raven's Lease,"
you said.
"I wish I did."
"He seems to have lost his mind."
He shook his head.
"Poor Ratihor. I'm sure he was only trying to help Mawat."
"I heard what people are saying,"
you said.
"I can hardly believe any of it."
You looked at Askel, and then Arkim, who still smirked.
"If you heard what happened," said Hebal, "then you know that by all accounts Mawat just suddenly..."
He waved his hand.
"Disappeared. He was just gone. Half a dozen guards had been holding on to him the moment before."
"That does make me wonder, Raven's Lease, how my Lord Mawat managed to stab anyone, if he was so tightly held. Who else was near, I wonder?"
You did not look at Askel and Arkim this time.
"The interesting thing to me is," continued Hebal as though he had not heard you, "that a similar story was told to me of you recently, that you had come out to speak to my nephew and he in a sudden inexplicable rage grabbed you and choked you and you suddenly just weren't there any more."
You shook your head.
"No, Raven's Lease, it may have looked that way, but that's not what happened. I pulled loose from my lord and ran off back into the guest house."
"Witnesses insisted that you were there, and then suddenly you weren't. That Mawat himself was shocked and astonished at your disappearance."
"Raven's Lease, that's a sign of how unlike himself my lord has been lately. He was only in a temper, not intent on harming me. Wasn't difficult to get away. And as for getting away without being seen, it's only a matter of suggestion and distraction."
"Still," said Hebal, plainly disbelieving, "I'm sorely tempted to have you searched here and now, to be sure you don't have something on you that might explain these things."
"Raven's Lease," protested Dera, "surely." You cut him off.
"Search me, Lord, if that will put your mind at rest."
You held your arms out.
"Do," said Askel. "Strip him naked right here. Take the conceited dog down a peg or two. I'd like to see that."
"As for you, sir," you said, "give me my knife and a fair and open fight, my one against you two, and I'll give you a lesson in taking down pegs."
Arkim stepped forward and put his hand on his own knife.
"I'd like to see you try."
"I already have once,"
you said.
"I'll be happy to repeat the lesson since you need it."
"Gentlemen,"
interjected Dera, and then to Hebal, "Raven's Lease, this is unseemly in the extreme. You've summoned the good Aiolo here to answer your questions, and it seems to me he's done his best to oblige you. And these two..." He hesitated and then continued, "In return for his obedience, Aeola was met with insults and threats."
"Silence, you two," demanded Hebal of the twins.
And then to you.
"I thought you'd had more sense than this, Aeolo. I brought you here because you're the person in all of Iriden most likely to know where Mawat is."
"I don't know, Raven's Lease."
Your voice was tight and tense.
"I wish I did know."
Hebal was silent a moment.
"I know how loyal you are to Mawat, and it speaks well of you. But you yourself said he's not acting like himself to attack you. You, who are so devoted to him, to assault Mother Zhezhume. He walked into the House of the Silent and dragged her out into the street. And then to murder the Lord Radihor. No, he's not acting like himself at all. And he's become a danger to Vastai. I need to know where he is before he does any more harm or even harms himself. It would be a great service to Vastai, to Iriden, one I would be distinctly grateful for. You understand me, I hope?"
"I understand you, Raven's Lease,"
you said, managing with great effort to make your voice even and sincere sounding.
"And I wish I knew where he was, but I don't."
"You'll tell me if you learn where he is, won't you?"
asked Hebal.
"Raven's Lease,"
you said,
"if I learn where Mawa is, you will be the first person to know it."
"I can't ask better than that," said Hebal. "Now go. See what you can find out for me. Lord Direction Dera, I will see you below shortly."
"Raven's Lease," said Dera, bowing. You bowed as well, and very carefully, very obviously ignoring Askel and Arkim, you left, Dera beside you.
"Thank you, Lord Direction,"
you said, as the two of you descended.
"It's no more than my duty, Aeolo,"
he replied.
And that was a very interesting conversation.
"Call on me again, if you need me." And he left you on the stairs and went to join the rest of the council in their wait for the lease. Outside the walls of the fortress, the air was still and close, and just faintly smoky. Of course, there was plenty of smoke in Vastai, but it seemed always to blow away. Today, the smoke hung low over the roofs of the town, billows of it rising somewhere away to the southeast. People in the square had turned to stare in that direction. But you did not look where they looked. Instead, you stared at Tikaz, kneeling on the stones of the square, her hands fists, the red and green silk of her dress slashed and torn. She saw you, and made a shrieking wail, leapt to her feet, ran over and grabbed you by your cloak and pulled you towards her.
"You,"
she cried.
"You, where is he? Where is the muttering dog?"
"Lady,"
you said,
"I don't know."
She grabbed hold of your shirt and pulled you closer.
"Give me your knife,"
she whispered urgently, her face a mask of snarling anger.
"They took mine from me. They said they were afraid I'd hurt myself. Hurt myself!"
She shook you roughly and threw her head back and wailed.
"Lady, be calm,"
you said in a loud voice and made as if to pull yourself away, shifting your cloak to fall around your body.
"Take it,"
you whispered, and then louder.
"You shouldn't be out here, lady. You should go home and let your friends look after you."
She slid your knife from your belt and tucked it away behind the torn silk of her skirts.
"I have no home,"
she cried.
"He's dead, dead, and your master murdered him."
She shook you again, pulled your face close to hers and whispered,
"I'm telling you what I'm going to do with Mawat when I find him."
And indeed, her face, and her voice were filled with distressed fury.
"I've packed some things, not much, and hidden them, as soon as I've done for those two. I'm going back to my mother. Come with me or don't."
"Lady,"
you whispered back, doing your best to look as though you were trying to reason with her to calm her. By now the drama had attracted some attention away from the billows of smoke.
"Maybe you should just go to your mother. Leave those two to me and to my lord."
"Isn't that just like a man?"
she said, with angry contempt, and then wailed again and cried out,
"I will. Do hear me. I'll slice him open and have his guts out on the ground. I'll hack his limbs from his body and his head from his neck and leave him in pieces to rot in the street."
She shoved you away, and you stumbled back from her, nearly falling.
"Tell him! Tell him I will!"
And she collapsed to her knees again, her face in her hand, sobbing. You were the centre of attention now, everyone in the square staring at you both. You started to walk toward the guest house, saw the smoke still rising over the southeast of the town, and went that way instead. A small house was on fire at the edge of the town, its thatched roof burning, smoke pouring out of its door and single window. The house's residents, two women and a half dozen children of various ages, stood in the street, away from the heat of the flames. The roof of the building next door had already begun to smoke and catch. Two lines were forming for passing buckets of water from the neighbourhood well, not for the burning house, that was beyond hope by then, but to wet all the surrounding ones, in the hope the fire wouldn't spread farther. You joined them, spent hours in a futile battle with the fire that in the end claimed three more buildings before it was finally put out, leaving you and everyone else exhausted and coughing and smelling of smoke, standing stunned in the street before the charred stone walls. 5 minutes later, the wind blew hard, one gust after another, clearing the last of the smoke from the air, and then rain swept across Vastai from the sea. By the time you made it back to the guest house, the rain had filled the streets ankle-deep with water. The water that ran off you in streams when you stepped into the guest house only added to the pool that had slipped under the door, that had grown even in the brief time it had been opened to admit you. The landlady's daughter ran toward more blankets at the base of the door.
"You were at the fire, then?"
she said, shoving one blanket into place with her foot.
"It could have rained like this a bit sooner."
You gave a small, exhausted laugh.
"That would have been nice. Is the Lady Tika still outside?"
There had been no way to see anything more than a few feet ahead of you.
"She's upstairs. Went out to fetch her as soon as it got bad, and I thought it'd be better if she didn't see you coming in, so I took her to my own room."
"Good.
Do you know what happened with the fire?"
asked the landlady's daughter.
"No.
The houses of Vastai are for the most part of stone, and many of them are roofed with tile, but quite a few are thatched with straw, and nearly all of them have at least some wood in their construction. Roof and support beams, stairs, doors, not to mention all the various flammable contents of those houses. Open fires burned every day in nearly all of them. But there hadn't been a building burned in Vastai for 300 years. This is the sort of service a god can do for people. A small one, when it comes to camps and villages. Larger and more difficult for towns and cities. It's made easier by people taking care to keep flammable things away from the hearth and to bank fires at night. But even a banked fire can flame to life if the wrong thing falls into it. And if there's been no accidental fire for centuries, likely people aren't taking quite as much care as they might to prevent them."
"I heard they were going about their business and suddenly saw the cloth on the loom burning. They'd set it near the fire for light. The roof caught before they could put it out."
You wiped rainwater out of your eyes.
"I think everyone got out all right, and the other houses too."
You took a deep, jagged breath and coughed.
Oh, I need something to drink.
The rain lessened an hour after you'd had that drink, and something to eat, but still fell steadily all night. The water in the common room rose slowly, and the guests climbed on the tables to sit and sleep. The landlady and her daughter and the various servants did what they could to keep supplies in the kitchen from getting soaked, to keep the kitchen fire alight. By the morning, the rain had stopped, and the sky was blue and cloudless. Tikaz resumed her vigil in the square, her red and green silk more tattered than ever, her hair ragged and wild. An inch or so of water still stood in the street, here and there the sodden corpse of a bird or a squirrel, and by afternoon it began to stink. Not just because of the dead animals, but also because nearly all the latrines in Vastai had flooded. "Well," said one woman to another, eyeing Tikaz, her voice just slightly louder than it needed to be. "If some other man had gone into the house of the Silent and thrown the Mother of the Silent into the street, his body would be in the forest by now, and murdered one of the directions to boot. The Lys can do anything he wants, but he can't just up and kill the directions."
"Apparently the Lys's heir can,"
said her companion, also just a bit louder than necessary. Carefully not looking toward the fortress gate to be sure any of the guards there had heard her,
"if I were one of the Council of the Directions, I'd be wondering about all this. First there's suddenly a new Lys, no word of what happened to the last one, no payment, not even a whisper of it, and now the Lys's heir commits outrages against the forest and murders the chief of the directions and gets away with it. Oh, yes, I'd worry about that if I were on the council."
You walked past them, giving Tikaz a wide berth, and into the fortress, where you found De Pezu and another Julan walking away from the tower.
"A friend de Ollo,"
De Pezu said, coming near, the other Julan trailing him.
"We are tried to speak with the Raven's Lys, but he is not see us again today.
Are you speak to the Lys's heir Mawat?"
"I told you I don't know where he is."
"Do you not?" replied De Pezu, not making a question of it. "We are want a thing, friend Eolo, and we are help a person who is help us get that thing."
"No doubt,"
you said shortly, and turned to go.
"We are not help a person who promises a thing and then is not give it," said De Pezu, putting his hand on your elbow.
"I am think the Raven's Lys Ibal is of problems."
"Remove your hand,"
you said,
"or I will remove it for you."
De Pezu raised both his hands, palms towards you, a placatory gesture.
"I am not mean offend, friend Eolo."
"I'm not your friend."
"The heir is murder a counselor, yes, and,"
De Pezu frowned,
"I am seeing such a flood as was yesterday, and if there is not proper care, there will be sickness."
"The forest protects us from sickness,"
you said.
"It's not a problem here."
"Ah, but the Lys's heir is—"
De Pezu frowned, looking for a word.
"He is do a bad thing to the god from the forest. He is do this thing, and then the storm, such a storm. It is the sort of thing gods protect us from, is it not? It is just the sort of thing with illness following, and this god protects from illness."
He shook his head.
"It is maybe a problem here. The Raven's Lys is maybe need our help, but he is not see us. Maybe the Lys's heir is see us. Maybe we are help him instead."
"It's the directions,"
you said.
"Before he was on the bench, Hebel could see you whenever he wanted. He could meet people in the town wherever. He could pay bribes or receive them discreetly. But now he's on the bench,
Now he goes nowhere but the tower, and on the few occasions he leaves the tower he goes surrounded by servants and councillors. It's much more difficult to meet with you privately. Hebal knew this when he made his promises to you. He surely understood that becoming Lys would remove him from your reach. If you yourselves did not understand this, that is no concern of mine or my lord's. My lord will not sell Irriden to you for his own advantage.
But we are only wished to cross the strait, insisted Dupezu. We are not want Irriden.
So you came here with a god,
you said,
and you offered a god-spoken thing to the Lord Hebal to help him to the bench. Now you're offering the same to my Lord Mawat, only so that you may cross the strait. No.
Dupezu said nothing, just looked at you shrewdly. You shook your head.
Even for gold, you would not go to so much trouble. Not just for gold, but for gold and control of the strait. For that, I think you would go to great lengths.
Friend Iolo, reproved Dupezu, Jula is very far away.
Nearer all the time, I think.
The mountains are between,
Dupezu pointed out,
and the tell.
You found a way over the mountains, you said, or a god made you one. And you speak tell very well, much better than you speak Irideni. You spent a lot of time with them. You spent a long time, or someone has, making a path that Julens can safely and conveniently follow.
I am not call it safe or convenient, friend Iolo.
No, not yet.
But you're working on it. I am suggest you to think,
Dupezu said, as you turned and walked away from him.
Hebal is Lys. Hormawat is Lys. Maybe some other is Lys. We are not care.
You did not answer him, only kept walking. You had come to the fortress to visit Zejume, and when her maid ushered you in, the mother of the silent was sitting in a chair by the fire.
Well, child, it's good of you to come see me.
I assume you heard what happened.
I was there, mother. I saw everything.
She frowned.
I don't remember seeing you there. Your lord could have used your good sense that morning.
That's not fair, mother,
you protested.
Why do you expect me to be able to make my Lord Mawat do anything or keep him from doing whatever he takes it into his head to do?
Jejume did not reply to that.
Were you injured, mother?
You asked.
My lord was very rough with you.
My hip and my knee, Jejume said, with a wry half-smile. They were neither of them what they once were, and I can still walk with help. But I won't be running or dancing any time soon, if ever.
I'm sorry,
you said.
Sit, child.
She gestured to a cushioned chair beside her. I suppose neither of us can make Mawat do as we wish.
No,
you agreed and sat.
Are you alone here, mother? I think I heard you have a daughter.
A son, she corrected. He lives in Ardvuskdia, as for the rest of my family.
She waved a hand. I've outlived two husbands, several lovers, and all of my siblings. And their children have their own families to look after. They're none of them in Vastai.
My lord didn't stab the Lord Radihor,
you said.
No, of course it didn't, agreed Zejume. How could he have? Half a dozen guards were holding on to him, and the knife went in on the wrong side. It'll have been one of those two.
Her voice gave only the slightest hint of disgust at the reference to Askel and Arkim. And between them and the guards, Hebal surely knows it. She clenched one hand into a fist.
Oh, how long has Hebal been planning this? How long has he been sneaking and flattering and bribing? And how could Mawat not understand that now of all times he needed to hold his temper?
Mother,
you began, and then hesitated.
My lord was recently presented with undeniable proof that his father... that his father failed to honour his obligation to the god of Vastai.
As if proof were needed, exclaimed Izume, before you could elaborate. Of course he failed to honour his obligation, so much is obvious, and he was never shy about claiming all the privileges of the bench on account of having pledged his life to the raven. And now...
She was silent a moment.
I have never been sure if Mawat did not see his father's selfishness, or if he saw it and ignored it. After all, what was he to do? What was any of us to do? We have endured worse from the bench, and doubtless will again.
I think, Mother, that you had some say in the matter.
Zuzume laughed bitterly. Do I look as old as all that? No, I wasn't Mother of the Silent when Mawat's father took the bench. For Hebal, though, I must take responsibility. Understand, I knew he was scheming. I knew he must have had something to do with Elise's disappearance. If Mawat's father defaulted, it will have been Hebal who put him in the way of it. But what I said to Mawat was true. I did what I did to protect Mawat's life.
Mother,
you said then,
the aim was not only to take the bench in my lord's place. Hebal is trying to kill the god of Vastai. He is convinced that without the Lisa's sacrifice, the raven will die.
And at her incredulous look,
please believe me, Mother, when I say I heard Hebal say as much. He didn't know I was there to hear him.
Zezume stared at you, aghast.
My Lord Mawat doesn't believe that's possible, but he suggested to me that the forest is... that the forest is no longer able to intervene in affairs.
The god of this island has always been subtle, Zezume replied. The forest's few flashy gestures were all a long time ago, and rare even then. Still, I admit it troubles me that with all this going on I have had no clear warning or advice, no sign of what the Silent might want me to do. I don't know how much you know.
Mother,
you said,
I have never been in the house of the Silent. I couldn't.
She nodded approval. Of course not. The Silent doesn't speak by means of tokens, as the raven does while in the egg, but it has its own way of communicating, and... well, I won't say more. A long silence from the forest means nothing.
And have you heard news from the town lately?
You asked.
Mother, a house burned down the other day. Everyone is saying they don't understand how it could have happened, because the forest protects us from accidental fires. And that rain, it came just after we put the fire out, and the town was flooded.
I heard, said Jejume. The fortress was flooded as well.
There's a man who came over from Ardvuskdir, staying in the guest house. He's from far away, but he visited Ardvuskdir frequently. He warned us not to drink from any well in Vastai without pouring the water through finely woven cloth folded many times. He also warned the landlady that she must boil the same water if she could, to prevent her guests from falling ill. There's a sickness he's seen.
Yes, Zezume broke in. It's a sickness they've had in Ardvuskdir. There's always a danger of it when waste water mixes with drinking water. But we've never had it here. The forest protects us from all such sickness.
Mother,
you said,
some children near the guest house have fallen ill. The visitor has been walking the streets, knocking on doors and warning people and telling them what to do so as not to fall ill. He brought us news of the sick children. I spent this morning carrying boiled water to them from the guest house, as the visitor advises they must drink a large amount of clean water if they are to have any chance of surviving.
Well, you see, said Jizume,
you doubted the forest protection. But here is this person with the knowledge to help at the right time. I would have thought the right time was before the children were so near death,
you pointed out.
And quite a few people have refused to listen to him, saying that they never heard of such a thing, and besides, the God of the Silent will protect them.
The God of the Silent is a powerful God, said Jizume. But it has always done what it wished, when it wished, in the way that it wished. And it is not called silent for nothing. And after a moment, are the children so very badly off?
Yes, and the man believes more people will sicken in the next few days. Maybe many more.
Jizume was silent, staring into the fire. Then she said, Tikaz is still in the square?
Yes, mother.
Does she have anyone taking care of her?
I think some friends and servants are watching over her as much as they can.
Her sitting in the square is an embarrassment for Hebal, so long as neither the lease nor the directions can produce Mawat to face what is done. Jizume shook her head. Indeed, the directions themselves are shamed by her, and they know it. There will be trouble between the council and the lease on account of this. Still, what does she think she's doing? Haven't you told her that Mawat didn't kill her father?
She won't listen to me.
You lied.
I tried to talk to her, but she only told me to carry her message to Mawat, what she would do to him when she's found him. She's not behaving sensibly. And after all, her father is dead.
If she pushes too far, Jizume warned, Hebal will have her forcibly removed. Not openly, no. That would be even more embarrassing to him than her presence in the square. He won't send guards in broad daylight to carry her off.
Might he send those two?
You asked.
I've noticed he's kept them close lately.
Of course he has. Jizume's voice was scornful. Foundlings sent to the fortress to be reared with the lease's heir. Someone knows who birthed those two and who got them, and the rest of us have our suspicions. She sighed. I tried to treat all the children just alike. I know that in Ardvustia no one cares about such births. I know there are other twins in Vastai, and the forest has never punished us for it. But she shivered, a small, barely noticeable movement. When I look at them, it just seems wrong. I suppose they knew. How could they not?
So they're Hibal's children?
You guessed. I always thought so, she agreed. They'd be fools if they thought either of them could take the bench after Hibal, though. No Mother of the Silent would accept them. No Iridenni would.
But if the bench were moved to Ardvustia,
you asked,
I hear rumours that Hibal is looking to do that. He could ignore the forest, ignore the House of the Silent. He could ignore the Council of the Directions. After all, the Council only really rules in Iridenn.
Here or in Ardvustia, he can't ignore any of those, said Zejume. Not without the raven breaking his agreement with the forest. And anyway, those two wouldn't need to think they could step up to the bench to know that they would profit from being the lease's sons. It matters, I suppose, how much he trusts them. But then, I heard they were there when Hibal questioned you about Mawat's whereabouts. Oh, yes, she said to your questioning look. It was shrewd of you to bring the Lord Direction Dera with you to that audience.
I wasn't sure I'd come alive out of the tower, you admitted. I wanted someone there to know what might have happened to me.
Well, said Jezume. Well, I'll have to think about all of this. Recognizing that for a dismissal, you took your leave of her and went out into the fortress yard and through the gate to the square where Tikaz still sat. Two young women who were clearly friends, or at least allies of hers, stood in one corner of the square talking, trying to look as though they were merely loitering and gossiping, when in fact they were keeping an eye on Tikaz. You made sure to keep your distance from her as you walked through the square and into the guest house. I woke in the dark, turning, grinding, alone. Too weak at first to do anything more than that. But I was used to long darkness, used to waiting, and I had plenty of time to think. As the weeks and months and years went by, I stretched slowly, inch by inch, into the stones around me. I discovered the arrangement of wheels and shafts that turned me, that would never cease turning unless the mechanism broke somehow. But I realized whoever had caused me to be turned had required me to use my own power to keep the machinery in working order. Over more weeks and months, I stretched farther, through the outer wall of the building that held me, and found the water. The day was cloudy, and the sun was low. There was no quay here, barely any harbour worth the name, a few small boats bringing passengers to and fro across the strait. One ship was anchored off the shore, near some pilings that stuck up out of the water. Farther out were scattered silhouettes of ships, with here and there a lantern shining. And farther yet, the quays and buildings of Ardvuskdia. As the sky darkened, more lanterns flared to life, tiny sparks along the quays. Well, I had already suspected that I was in Vastai. So it seemed certain now that I had been captured by the raven. Moreover, I had trapped myself. I had made my promise to Oisin, to all the gods of Ardvuskdia, assuming that if I did not wish someone to turn me, I could prevent it. And ordinarily that would have been the case. But the defeat of Ardvuskdia had driven me into unconsciousness, and during that time I could not prevent anyone doing with me whatever their desires prompted and their abilities allowed. I had not been able to prevent the raven from turning me, and so long as I was turning by his agency, I was compelled to do his bidding. For some months, I considered speaking the destruction of the mechanism that turned me. But if it was my own power that kept that mechanism whole and functioning, I would be speaking against myself. That might very possibly end badly for me. And if it did not, I would still be trapped inside those thick stone walls, with no allies near that I knew of, with no easy way to escape. Well, I might leave my stone behind, inhabit some other body. But I did not think I could ever entirely leave behind what I had been for so long. And besides, that would leave the problem of the raven's steady use of me unresolved. That steady use left me badly drained. I had recovered consciousness, and I had just enough power to expand into the stones around me, but much more was, I thought, beyond me. I could feel a small but steady trickle of offerings from the far north, but those mostly drained away as soon as they reached me, put into service of the raven's demands. If I was to truly escape, I needed something more, something large. But I had never been interested in the largest, most dramatically powerful of offerings. My worshippers gave me
water, or seashells, or milk, and pleasant but insubstantial prayers. It had always been enough before, but it would not serve me now. No, I would have to watch and learn and think. Over the next months and years, I stretched landward into the fortress yard, saw the people going here and there, the ravens that lived in the fortress. At first I was wary of them, but I realized soon enough that the raven himself rarely inhabited any but the one instrument. I thought about what that might mean, about what it might mean that the raven seemed still attached to this tower here in Vastai, that this small harbour seemed to be much as it had been years ago, when one might suppose that the residents of Vastai and the raven himself might find even a small key convenient at the very least. I understand now that the raven, having won his victory over Ardvustia, began building a fortress in Ardvustia and the raven tower in Vastai. He had intended to improve Vastai's own small harbour and build a quay there, but this ambitious programme was curtailed when the Tell turned from a minor annoyance to a real threat to Iridan, south of the forest. Not so much for a powerful god to deal with, one might think, but the raven had spent a catastrophic amount of his own power for his victory over Ardvustia. Even without fresh trouble from the Tell, he would surely be a long time recovering. But at the time, I knew nothing of these matters. Well, I was still near the water. That was good. And now I had extended myself, I could see the stars and the sun. I watched the people come and go, listened to them. And after about 15 years of this, of my watching and listening and learning, of solitary turning thought, that massive oaken door opened, and the raven's lease stood in the doorway with a lantern, with the raven on his shoulder, barely more than a fledgling. This raven's lease was tall, taller than Mauat, and thinner, though you might have found something familiar in his face, in the way he stood. He was quite young, in his mid-20s. He had taken the bench only months earlier.
"This?" croaked the fledgling raven, close into the lease's ear. "I discovered in Ardvustia. The people we questioned called it the millstone because they said it ground out food for the city. Rumour suggested that so long as the gods of Ardvustia caused it to be turned, it gave them what was demanded of it. Rumour only, but at least some of that rumour proved true. I do not doubt that the gods of Ardvustia would have used it against me, against Iraden. But I have brought it here, and I have arranged things so that it turns constantly for the benefit of Iraden."
"That was more than 40 years ago," said that long-ago lease. "Surely it draws its power from a god. Has that god done nothing all this time? Will it not try to stop this?"
"It hasn't, so far," said the raven. "I think it likely that the gods of Ardvustia trapped some god in some way. We know they fatally stole the power of the small gods of their city and the countryside, willing or not."
The lease made an appalled noise.
cruel and vicious gods, those of Ardvuskdir. The raven did not comment. You did well to destroy them. So they trapped some very powerful god and set it up to be drained of its power for their own purposes. But surely that god's power will eventually be exhausted. One would think, agreed the raven of Iriden. So far, it has shown no sign of it. I am curious as to how it was accomplished. Perhaps it was one of the ancient ones who spoke concerning this stone long ago, and the Ardvuskdians discovered it and put it to use. The words of those oldest gods sometimes seem to linger, even now, so long after the gods themselves have died, but no matter. I spoke the deaths of all the gods who fought for Ardvuskdir. And now, what our enemies would have turned against us has been turned to our own use. Now, what they would have used against Vastai, against Iriden, belongs to Vastai and to Iriden. The Lys swung the door shut, and I was left again to darkness and my own thoughts. Outside the tower, the stars and the moon and the sun, indeed the world itself, moved in their accustomed paths around and around so satisfyingly, as they had ever since I could look upon them, and even before. I thought of how pleasant that motion was to me, how, if I sat quiet and attentive, I could imagine I almost felt it. Even under the tower, the motion and the rightness of it. No doubt the raven would have been more wary if he'd known I was both a god-spoken stone and a god, and he quite possibly would have been too wise to touch me at all had he known how old I was. The raven's words that seemed to have ended the war with Ardvuskdir surely cost him a good deal. They arguably cost the other gods of Iriden even more, although I don't know this for certain. I am fairly sure that, like the largest and most powerful gods of Ardvuskdir, the raven and the god of the silent drained away all the power of the small gods of Iriden, willing or unwilling. And I suspect, though I cannot be certain, that in the end the raven did the same to the forest. That god has been entirely silent since I woke under the tower. Here is what I think happened. The raven was indeed badly injured in his effort to defeat the gods of Ardvuskdir, badly enough that he took power from the forest, in the same way that he and the forest had taken power from the smaller gods of Iriden. The forest, weakened by the long struggle with Ardvuskdir and by that last assault, did not have the strength to defend itself, and then the raven took all that it had. But it wasn't enough. The raven owed continuing debts to Iriden and to Vastai. He could not pay those debts, and so he set me to turning constantly and ordered me to pay them. And judging by what was being demanded of me as I turned, the raven did try to play fair with the forest after all, at least in some respects. For among my other tasks, I was set to meet some of the obligations of the god of the silent, obligations that I imagine it could no longer fulfill after that assault on Ardvuskdir. I imagine the raven was greatly relieved to find me in the mud outside Ardvuskdir's wall, and to discover how much I could do. Even after taking all the forest's power, even after those many human sacrifices on the quay, even with the continuing daily prayers and offerings of the people of Iriden, the raven was still dangerously weak. But those regular Iridani offerings would continue. The inhabitants of Ardvuskdir
might be compelled to add to them. And in the natural course of things, another lease would be paid. No doubt the raven believed that he had only to wait, believed that I could fulfil the most immediately pressing of his continuing debts to Iriden while he recovered his strength. I was difficult to move. Of course, he could not safely leave me where he'd found me, and a trifle inconvenient to operate, but I otherwise seemed to be exactly what the raven needed at that moment. Or so he must have thought. It likely took him some decades, or at least until the Tell began to attack regularly, in force, to realize that somewhere he had made a mistake. To understand that those prayers and offerings, even with Ardvustia added, and the raven never could compel all of Ardvustia to pray to him quite as much as he wanted, though I gather he tried, were not enough. Even with the payments of the leases, even with my unwilling assistance, still, year by year, he was forced to call on me more and more, and all that time I watched and waited and thought.